ranked one of America's top research universities, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries on UWM today. Here's the host, Tom Lujack, Vice Chancellor of University Relations.
Milwaukee is a town where drinking alcohol, sometimes a lot of alcohol, is an honored tradition. With a history of being home to many breweries, both large and small, our community and our state have celebrated our drinking culture. But, as we all know, there are casualties in the landscape of free-flowing beer and cocktails. One of the often unspoken problems involves the physical abuse that can occur in relationships where one of the partners becomes violent after consuming too much alcohol. On this edition of UWM Today, we talk with a UWM researcher studying the impact that alcohol has on violence that occurs between intimate partners. Our guest is Ryan Shorey, an assistant professor of psychology in UWM's College of Letters and Science. Welcome, Ryan. It's good to have you on today's program.
Thank you for having me.
How did you get interested in the notion of studying violence triggered by alcohol use in these personal relationships?
It started when I was an undergraduate student at Grand Valley State University, so on the other side of the lake. And I had a professor there who was studying dating violence among college students. And we looked at a lot of factors related to it. Substance use always seemed to show consistent findings, especially alcohol, that it increases the risk for violence. And then when I went to graduate school, I had a mentor who has focused the last 30 years of his career focused on alcohol-related intimate partner violence. And so from there, I've just kind of kept studying it and trying to figure out how to prevent this issue.
So there have been studies before on this topic, although I think many times when people think about what happens when you have too much to drink, the stereotypical image of a barroom brawl may come to mind. But that's very different from the violence that occurs in these intimate relationships.
Yeah, we've known for quite a while, at least in the research community, that alcohol increases the risk for violence against an intimate partner. It's really something I think that's gained more media attention recently, and something that the field has started to do more fine-grained analysis of who's at risk for this and when is it most likely to happen so that we can try to prevent the problem.
Well, let's talk about your specific project and how you're going about trying to measure the degree to which this is a problem here in Milwaukee.
Sure. Yeah, so we have a couple of projects right now where we're trying to figure out when and for whom is alcohol most likely to increase the risk for perpetrating physical violence, psychological violence, which would be yelling, shouting, name-calling, threats, as well as sexual violence. And so what we do is we try to study the events as close in time as we can to when they happen. So immediately after or maybe even a few hours after, asking folks about what was going on and how much alcohol they had consumed prior to that event.
Boy, that's a real intimate question. I mean, speaking about trying to get details, how do you get people to admit that they have behaved badly?
Yeah, so it's certainly a sensitive topic. And so one thing, we guarantee confidentiality to our research participants so that they know the data that they share with us is going to stay with us and be used for good purposes. The other thing is that these are traumatic events. And what we find is that people often appreciate the opportunity to talk about or disclose these problems that they're having in their relationships to someone where that information is going to remain confidential. And so I think for those reasons, we see very high rates of participation and disclosing, which is unfortunate, a tremendous amount of violence.
Are both partners in the relationship engaged in the conversations with you? Are they both sharing information about what happened and what triggered the violence?
Yeah. So in some of our studies, we do get both partners. And then in some of our studies, we get just one person in the relationship. So one study we have right now, are both partners are completing surveys every day for 60 straight days so that we can see when the risk for violence is greatest and whether drinking by one or both partners increases that risk for violence.
What have you found so far? Is the problem greater when both of the people in the relationship have been consuming alcohol?
It's a good question. We still don't know, so our data collection's almost over. And there's really surprisingly not much research in this area to guide us. So theoretically, we would think that if both people are drinking, the potential for conflict in a relationship would be greater and the risk for violence would be greater than if just one person or neither of them are drinking. But hopefully in the next, I would say, about 6 months, we should know the answer to that question.
Again, stereotypical image, you know, if you have a heterosexual couple, the traditional thinking, I suppose, is that it would be the man who is violent and the woman who is the victim.
Yes.
Have you found that that is always the case?
So our research actually finds fairly equal rates of physical and psychological perpetration by men and women. We see much higher rates of men perpetrating sexual violence against women. And that's kind of a controversial topic in our field. We do see that men perpetrate more severe violence. They're more likely to cause injuries to their partner, and women are more likely to have negative outcomes due to intimate partner violence. But in the age group we study, which is young adults, about the 18 to 25-year-old range, we see what we call bidirectional violence, that both partners are perpetrating violence against each other. That's the most common thing that we see.
So when you contact people and ask them to get involved in the study, do you already know that there is a problem with violence in that relationship, or are you just putting the call out and whomever says, yeah, I'll take part in this study? Is that the first time that you find out that there's an issue?
Sometimes we do it both ways. So in some of our studies, we recruit anybody regardless of if they have violence in the relationship or not, so that we can also look at what's keeping couples from perpetrating violence. That's an important question we want to know as well. And then some studies we focus specifically on folks who have had prior violence in their relationship.
How do you find the subjects?
So we do quite a few things. We post a lot of study flyers, both around campus and in the community. At UWM, we have research participation in psychology, so students can choose to participate in studies for extra credit. And we also use social media to recruit participants, Facebook, Twitter, and all of those available resources.
And especially if you're working with an 18 to 25-year-old age cohort, those social media platforms are critical for getting word out that this is going on.
Yes, they use social media quite often, so it's a good recruitment tool for us.
If you discover through the admissions that come from subjects that violence has occurred, is there any legal issue here of having that information? I'm thinking specifically about domestic violence. If the police got a call from one of the two people in a relationship, typically the person accused of domestic violence is taken into custody until
Sure.
they can sort things out. Does that ever enter into play when you're dealing with these couples who clearly have some issues?
So, yeah, one of the important things to know, so we're studying folks who are over the age of 18. And so legally, because we're in the research context, we are able to keep their records confidential. And that's for a very important reason, to understand the problem. It'd be tough to get folks to agree to participate if they knew we were going to call the police on them.
Yeah.
Now, that's
I want to participate, and by the way, I know I'll get busted
if I
act up.
Right. Now, that's not to say if someone told us that they were at risk, if they were, you know, in imminent danger, we would, of course, call the police and keep them safe. The other thing, too, a lot of our studies are supported by the National Institutes of Health, and they also have protections to help keep our research data confidential so that the participants can feel safe disclosing that information to us.
How long has the study been going on?
So our current study right now, we have one that's been going on for about the last 3 years. And then we have another study that's using a mobile app to collect data that's just began in February.
Now, there's a term, as I was doing research for today's program, there's a phenomenon that you describe as alcohol myopia.
Yeah.
What is that?
Yeah. So alcohol myopia, we can kind of think of a narrowing of attention. So kind of we can think of it as tunnel vision. So when folks drink, the higher our blood alcohol content gets, so the more intoxicated we get, the narrower our focus of attention becomes. So if we have conflict, say, with our partner and we're drinking, it's more likely that our attention is going to be focused heavily on that conflict and less on behaviors that would reduce that conflict or less on thoughts about what could be the consequence if violence were to occur.
So it's like a tunnel vision. If they get in a bad space, they're oblivious to other options that might be out there.
Exactly, right. It's hard to shift focus when someone's drinking from one thing to the next. And so when we get hooked on something that's really powerful, that's capturing our emotions and intoxicated, we tend to stay there.
I know that the study is still going on, and so you don't have all of the results, but have you had conversations at this point in the study with participants who admit that they have become violent, either dealing out psychological or physical abuse to their partner? Have you had conversations that tries to delve into why they keep doing this, or have they considered getting help?
Sure. So a lot of our data collection is primarily through self-report measures or through surveys that they complete on the internet and not necessarily, say, one-on-one conversations. But what we're able to capture in those daily surveys are behaviors that they're engaging in so that we can see what's predicting violence over time, what's predicting people from perpetrating violence and then stopping. And then every time they fill out a survey, folks get referral information for domestic violence so that if they want to seek help, they're able to do so.
Yeah. And your point is that unless you gather sufficient data, you really don't know what the best treatment or intervention measure might be.
Right.
Unless you can test this in a broad cross-section of the population.
Exactly right. We want to be able to capture enough episodes of violence so that we can truly understand across the population what's the biggest risk factors for perpetrating violence so that we can target our resources towards those risk factors.
You're listening to UWM Today here on WUWM. Good to have you with us this week. I'm Tom Lujack, and joining us in the studio is Ryan Shorey. Ryan is an assistant professor of psychology at UWM's College of Letters and Science and working on a research project that involves the study of the use of alcohol in relationships, more specifically in intimate relationships, people who live together and are troubled because of the abuse, either physical or verbal abuse that can be triggered with the overuse of alcohol. Ryan, this study that you're involved in right now, are the subjects all here in Wisconsin or the Milwaukee area, or is this national scale?
Yeah, so we have both. So we have some studies that are just here in the Milwaukee area, and we have a couple of studies that are starting now that are going to be both here in Milwaukee and then in Knoxville, Tennessee, so that we can see if there's any differences across those sites. We don't expect any. We think the same processes are occurring regardless of where someone's consuming alcohol, but it'll give us a little bit more confidence in what we find.
At the beginning of the program, I talked about the fact that we have a big drinking culture here in Milwaukee, a celebrated drinking culture, for good or for bad. Is it possible that because there's such widespread acceptance of indulging in alcohol, overindulging in alcohol, that the problem might be exacerbated in a community like Milwaukee? Or once you start drinking and you have issues, doesn't it not matter matter whether or not there's this drinking culture?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I came to UWM about a year ago. And so that's been something that's been on my mind that I'm hoping to investigate a little bit more. We do know from other researchers in different parts of the country that we see this correlation between the number of alcohol outlets, so bars, liquor stores, and domestic violence. And so that could be because people are drinking more, that they have maybe more conflict and greater opportunity. But that's something I'm hoping to study more as I get a little bit more acquainted with Milwaukee.
What about the age? You're studying, you said 18 to 25-year-olds. That's the group that you're focused on right now. Any evidence that that the violence increases as people get older?
Yeah. So that's one of the reasons we're studying 18 to 25-year-olds is that we see that intimate partner violence starts to increase and peak around that emerging young adult age range. And then remains stable for a little bit and then slightly goes down with age. But we still see high rates of violence and alcohol increasing the risk for violence in populations that are 30, 40, 50 years old.
What sort of percentages are we talking about?
It's pretty high and shocking. So physical violence we see in about 20 to 25% of intimate relationships every year. Psychological violence, which, as I said, includes threats of violence, swearing, put-downs, 70 to 80% of relationships. And then sexual violence, we have a little bit more of a spread there, different research methods. Somewhere between 10 to 25% of relationships experience sexual violence every year.
Wow. Wow, those are shocking numbers. Yeah. Is alcohol always involved?
It's not. For physical violence, we typically see somewhere between a third and two-thirds of all acts include alcohol. But what we know that alcohol isn't included in every act of violence, and alcohol maybe isn't a necessary cause of violence, that there's other things that are probably co-occurring with the use of alcohol to increase the risk for violence.
So this study that you're doing, which is focused on people who are using alcohol, is really just one beginning step of trying to understand that larger issue of domestic violence, because as you mentioned, alcohol doesn't have to be a factor to have people act badly.
Right. Yeah. Domestic violence is a complicated and complex problem with many predictors, many risk factors. Focusing on alcohol for us is one area where we feel we can make a difference because we know that we can help folks drink less if drinking is a problem. And so we think that if we can do that, we can help reduce some, but certainly not all, domestic violence.
I was intrigued to learn that you're using DNA samples from the subjects that you're studying in this research project. How does that work into the equation?
Yeah, so one question we're really interested in is who is at risk for perpetrating violence when they drink? Because we know not everybody perpetrates violence when they drink. And so working with some really great colleagues across the country, we're seeing if we can figure that out through folks' genetics. So are there genetic markers that could indicate someone's at increased risk for perpetrating violence when they drink? And so in our one study, we're getting saliva samples from our participants, and we'll be able to look at about 89 different genes to see if any of them increase that risk.
So that can be an important factor when you begin to analyze the results to see whether that genetic influence is more powerful than perhaps we ever imagined.
Yeah, and so one way we're thinking about this is certainly not that genetics are responsible for violence, but it could just be a marker of a risk, and helping folks become aware that they may have a risk would be one step towards addressing this problem.
You mentioned earlier that this particular study is relying upon self-reporting, so people essentially are plugging the data in. How do they keep a diary or how do they record these incidents?
Yeah, so we use an internet-based web data collection program called Qualtrics. And so a lot of folks get emails every day with a link to the survey. The other way we do it is through a web-based phone app. So we can download an app on participants' phones, and we can send them a notification when it's time for them to complete a survey, and they can complete the survey right there on their phone.
Wow. Is there ever a plan in your research to begin doing interviews with these individuals, so you not only have the data that comes from their self-reporting, but you can probe perhaps a little deeper about what else was going on in their mind besides the fact that it happened?
Yeah, so we have some plans moving forward to interview folks about specific instances of violence based on the findings that we get from these studies, so that we really know where to focus our questions so that we can get even more fine-grained information on specific episodes of violence.
I have to admit, I am just blown away that people are working with you on this. I mean, you know, in my mind, it's, I know you said it's common, but it also seems to me that there would be a degree of shame to admit that you're involved in physical or verbal abuse against your partner, and yet people still participate.
Yeah, and shame's a good thing to bring up. There is a lot of shame to sometimes admit these behaviors. And so one thing we really focus on when we work with our participants is respect for them, making sure they understand that we're not judging their experiences. We want to learn so that we can use that information to help other folks who are in violent relationships. And I think through that, it helps to open up so that people can disclose this information to us in a safe way.
Yeah, well, and thank goodness people are responding, because it's going to give you the information that you need to begin thinking about how to avoid or head off that violence in the first place.
Yes, definitely.
I also understand that you're involved in something called bystander training that you have started to do on college campuses. What is that about, and how does that factor into your study of alcohol and violence in relationships?
Yeah, so bystander training is a movement across the country on college campuses to train students on risk for sexual assault and how students can intervene when they see a situation that may be risky for a sexual assault occurring, so that they are active bystanders. And so these programs are pretty well established across campuses in the country. One criticism that we have of these programs is that they really don't focus on how alcohol plays a role in the vast majority of sexual assaults on college campuses. And so we're conducting a study right now where we're seeing if we can improve the outcomes of these bystander programs if we also help folks drink less, so that they can become more aware of when there are opportunities to be a bystander, so that they can intervene to keep other people safe.
Is there physical intervention that that is suggested here, or?
It's really up to the discretion of the participant. And so one thing we talk to our participants about is intervening in a way that's going to keep them safe as well. And so that could be something like calling the police. It could be telling a security guard if, say, you're at a bar. It could be before the event even occurs, so they may notice something that just kind of feels off to them. And so they may go talk to a friend or even a stranger who they think may be at risk, just to make sure that they're okay.
If a listener to this program is having an issue at home, if they themselves are the victim of violence in their relationship or the perpetrator, and this has given them some pause, what should they do?
So there's a few options. There are many people in the community who want to help. And so they can seek resources that are specific to domestic violence. There's Sojourner Family Peace Center in Milwaukee is a very well-known resource for domestic violence, which would be a great place to reach out to get help. That's also confidential, which is important. They could be going to a therapist or a social worker and talking about the issues. But just knowing that there are folks out there who want to help, who are trained to help, may be the first step.
Yeah, not keep it bottled up inside.
Yeah, these are issues that can kind of grow. And so anytime we see violence in a relationship, one thing we want to do is try to intervene quickly so that we can stop it from occurring again in the future.
I also understand one other piece that that you may be looking at is the role that alcohol has on minorities, sexual minorities.
Yeah.
What is that all about?
Yeah, so we're really excited about a new study we have that's being supported by the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism, where we're focused on how alcohol may interact with minority stress to increase the risk of intimate partner violence in non-heterosexual relationships. And minority stress broadly includes experiences such as discrimination and harassment that people may experience because of their marginalized status in society. And so what we think is happening is that alcohol may interact with those stressors to cause more conflict in a relationship. No one's looked at this. We're going to be the first study to look at this in depth over time. And we hope that this study can lead us to developing more effective intervention and prevention programs.
So does that mean engaging the LGBTQ community in projects like this?
Absolutely, yes. So that's something our team is working heavily on right now, both at the UWM campus and then in the city of Milwaukee as well.
So what do your students think about all of this? Students who may not be participating in the study, but you teach, you're in the psychology department, a very popular major with college students. When they learn about this work, are they surprised that that the problem is as prevalent as you've just outlined?
You know, a little bit. I see that being less of a surprise over time, which I take as a good thing because I think the word's getting out that domestic violence is a problem in relationships. And college campuses are doing, I think, a pretty good job of educating students when they come in that domestic violence and sexual assault are problems on college campuses and in the community as a whole. I think students are really interested in this.
So what are those classroom conversations like?
You know, it really depends. I often get asked a lot of, you know, how can we prevent it? How can we stop it? And that's kind of the question that no one's really figured out at this point. We keep testing interventions and we see some small effects, but we need more research to figure out how to truly intervene. And so we spend a lot of time talking about that process.
Wow. Well, you're doing important work and you're certainly in a great test tube if you think of Wisconsin and the drinking culture that we have. Hopefully, the fact that alcohol is so readily available and consumed so much will make more people feel comfortable that, yes, it causes problems and we should talk to people about it. As you've just described, there's some wonderful ways to go ahead and get help.
Yeah. Hopefully talking about it more will start to help folks see that there's resources that are available to help should they need it.
Well, thanks, Ryan. Great having you on today's program.
Thank you for having me.
Ryan Shorey, Assistant Professor of Psychology at UWM's College of Letters and Science, our guest on this edition of UWM Today. That's all for this week's program. We'll see you next week at the same time. Take care, everybody. I'm Tom Lujack.
You've been listening to UWM Today with host Tom Lujack, the weekly program where you get to meet the people behind one of America's top research universities, University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Playing a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin, UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Learn more at uwm.edu.